It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Hope you're having a wonderful Christmas Eve. Later on Central Time, we'll talk with a guest who wonders if the shopping mall as we know it is going extinct. That conversation's coming up in about half an hour. First, with Christmas just hours away, many of you are probably on your way home today. Maybe you're already there, but what exactly does home mean to you? A few months ago, we spoke with Sally Ohms, author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. I first picked up that book. I thought it was going to be about homelessness and Americans losing their homes. That's part of it. But it was a lot more than that, too. We talked about what exactly it meant to call a place home.
About 4 years ago, I decided I wanted to interview people around the country who had been displaced for various reasons, and then talk to them about what steps they took to recreate their homes and further what home means to them. So I sort of started out with what I now call ex-victims of natural disasters, because they've moved through it and found great solutions. But anyway, the book just sort of moved into wider interpretation of home, so that I ended up with about 10 groupings of people. And so I interviewed former foster kids, whom I think we know so often get tossed from home to home and sometimes even separated from their siblings. And I talked with combat veterans from various wars who are returning home and feeling ill at ease with that environment they used to call home. I talked with older people who are making that decision to move into a retirement home, or very often deciding or resisting that move, I guess. And I talked with immigrants who are now citizens about their cultural shifts, and Navajo women who are fighting to improve the quality of their homeland. Then I talked to a formerly battered woman, another woman whose home had been foreclosed on more than once, and a man in Santa Fe who says that if you follow his program, you don't have to be in that predicament anymore. And then I did speak with homeless men, women, and one child as well. Yeah.
We'll dig into some of those stories, but after talking to all these people and thinking about the concept of home for so long, what does home mean to you?
Putting me on the spot, eh?
Yeah.
I've lived a number of places, but I've felt at home in most of them. I think that for me, it has a lot to do with the person I live with, and also how comfortable I'm feeling with my life in general. And then I love living near a community of friends. That's very important for me. I heard a quote the other day. It said, "The bird a nest, the spider a web, man friendship." So I think that that can mean home. I mean, and that brings me to, there were just really lots of definitions I ran into. I mean, it's really just that building we live in, is it? I mean, although that figures in greatly for a number of people, that sense of place, but, I mean, we don't want to go telling people in Moore, Oklahoma, whose houses have been ripped away by tornadoes, or Colorado Springs, who've lost their houses to fire, that isn't the strict definition of home. But what I discovered is there's just a wealth of meanings and combinations of factors besides your obvious ones, your partner, your spouse, your family, your close relationships, your friends. But, I mean, it can mean a community and a region, a religion, spiritual practice, as in the case of the Tibetan American woman I interviewed in San Francisco. And sometimes I think it just, it means that people carry home around in their heads and sometimes in their hearts. Sometimes it's simply feeling comfortable within your own skin, but no matter what, it seems to me the common thread is that it's a place bound up with our identity and where we have that opportunity to be our authentic selves.
Well, let's explore that now through some of the stories that you tell, or your contacts tell in the book. And you said you started off looking at the impact of disaster. So let's start there. You talked to some people who had survived Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. What did you hear about them, about home?
Well, the woman who comes to mind is a woman in East Biloxi. Now, mind you, a lot of attention was on New Orleans, which I think rightfully so. It was sort of a monstrous situation there. But in East Biloxi, this woman had never experienced a hurricane to begin with, and then much less the fury of Katrina. And then she just couldn't believe that nothing really was in place to help people in this Mississippi Gulf town, right? and they were just in extreme crisis. They were overlooked for just days and months, and not the simplest things like water or food and no shelter. So even though her husband is the representative of their ward on the Biloxi City Council, there's still things did not get done there. And so while she was stunned, and she's still stunned that no one came to help them initially, she's just remarkably unbitter. And they receive amazing help from nonprofits and churches and just individuals around the country and private sources. And so they ended up setting up their own nonprofit that has become this sort of shining example. I mean, Oprah has donated to it. But I'm sure for her it was so hard to recall those days where there was just nowhere to bury dead people. Children had nothing to eat. They were being eaten alive by flies. But it just all sort of screamed third world treatment. But they moved right on through that and found, I think, that one of the things I learned along the way, and I think Krijah helped me with this, was that there is just a seemingly greater connection between and among people these days, and that there's great power in that connection. And then furthermore, I don't know, it comes to the fore when there are these times of crisis, you know, really hard times.
Is there a sense from some people you talk to, survivors of Katrina, also a major tornado elsewhere in the country, is there a sense of uncertainty about home when, you know, the place you live, in a sense, turns on you, the nature there attacks your house, the place you live?
Yes, and I say, you, when that first happens, then you've lost your home. That's it. And there's really a grieving process. I mean, besides the struggle, the physical struggle to just survive, there's that. The mayor of Greensburg, Kansas, who I interviewed and who initially called himself the mayor of nowhere because the tornado came through and took away the whole town. So it's that thing, that sort of grieving process. But I mean, I was amazed when I saw on the television a man in Moore, Oklahoma. It seemed like it was minutes after the tornado. He's there in a torn T-shirt but he's holds his fist up and he says, "We're going to rebuild." And there's that something that in human nature, I've read something that said, the thought that things are bound to improve is stitched into our human consciousness. And I think that's really a cool thing. And Greensburg ended up not only rebuilding, but rebuilding totally green. They built a lot of buildings according to LEED Platinum standards, and they're a little model city now.
Well, that's that attachment to home. I mean, some people might say, the heck with this place, I'm out of here. But there's also the response that you're talking about, like, this is our home, we're going to stay and make it better.
Yes, and I mean, some people do decide to leave, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, then they decide they will find some place that maybe won't have another tornado, or won't. Older people sometimes decide, well, then I'm going to go and live closer to my kin. But there are all sorts of scenarios. But that amazing spirit that seems to happen after disasters, where people just rally around, it's just really heartwarming to see.
That's Sally Ohms, author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. We'll hear more from her in a minute, but we also want to know, what does home mean to you? Will you be home for the holidays? You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. We're also on Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll get some more of the stories that Sally tells in her book in just a few moments. But first, we'll go to the phones. We've got Josie in Madison. Josie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi.
What does home mean to you? What did you want to tell us about?
Well I was raised by an Air Force officer, so we moved a lot by nature of that. I went to 13 schools before graduating high school. And then when I was, or 1997, so I must have been about 10, we lived in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and that's the year the flood hit, and we lost our home, we lost everything. And that really kind of shaped who my sisters and I, how we thought of home, because home was where our family was. We didn't have a house, we didn't have things to go back to. So I kind of developed a really transient idea of home. It was always where my things were. So then I went to university, and I did 4 semesters abroad, and I moved to London after graduating. and was always very content with that. I was very happy. And I came back to Wisconsin to visit my parents who were living here and met a man who lived in the same house from the time he was 12 until he was 32 when he married me. Hmm. And it was very, we have very different ideas of home. And we bought a house last year and I had a full-on panic attack because I've never lived in one house for more than 5 years. And he obviously lived in the same house for 20. So we have some interesting conversations in our house about how long we're going to stay in one spot, what home means. We have a baby on the way, so what does that mean for our baby? So it's a really interesting, totally different dynamic from where my husband comes from as where I come from.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that story, Josie. Well, two different concepts of what a home is, yeah. Sally, in the same household there.
Mean, and I find that it evolves for people. I think probably for all of us, but that's really an extreme case. That's just amazing, the things that that she's had to deal with and think about. But, yeah, absolutely.
And that also reminds me, you have a chapter, as you mentioned, about foster children who may never settle into a happy household. You had actually kind of inspiring stories about people who came out of that situation. Can you share that?
Yeah. In fact, I was thinking when your caller was talking, I was thinking of the former foster kids because that's the same sort of experience, although at least Josie, it sounded like, did have a family that she was traveling around with. But the foster kids that I talked to, the former foster kids, are being helped by an organization in San Diego that some people put together called Fostering Opportunities, and they give them scholarships to go to college. But they go a little farther than that. Then they go ahead and they help them. I think people probably know that when foster kids age out at 18, then lots of times they're just out on the streets, and they are out in the streets without any life skills. So this organization is also helping them with that. But one of the most amazing stories to me was a woman in San Diego County who, when I went to visit her, was living in a one-bedroom house, and she had adopted her teenage sister, and who was not the easiest because she'd been through foster care systems too. And so anyway, she also had in the one bedroom her 98-year-old grandfather, who was on hospice, and he was due to die within a week or so, which he did pass away. She was holding down three jobs. She was going to school. She just had this amazing spirit, and it was that thing of that things are bound to get better that she just continued with. But I just read you just the last little passage of hers, and she says, "I've been trying to find or make a home lots of times, but I've found it has to happen inside me. The only thing I can do is control me. I'm a spiritual person. I rely on a higher power, but I find that home is within myself." And I think that's what happens, and I think that's what your caller is talking about, and what she and her husband are talking about.
We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Mark in Richland Center. Hi there, Mark.
Hello. When you speak about staying in one place for a long time, the continuity that develops within a city is really dependent on people to be able to have that consistency. In Richmond, California, the mayor there, named Gail McLaughlin, had seen a very strong town falling apart with the recent economic crisis, and all of these people in a blue-collar town where she's the mayor in Richmond, California, through no fault of their own, watching these houses be foreclosed on by banks that created the problem, but the people themselves are losing their homes. And she sees her whole town fall apart by way of this process called foreclosure, and she says, this is crazy. There's nothing these people actually did that they should be losing their homes. And so on a proactive basis, she exercises eminent domain, takes the house from the bank, says to the person living in the house, you're underwater on your house, but you didn't do something that's really wrong. Well, the bank created this problem. So then she finds alternative financing and keeps people in their houses through the vehicle of eminent domain. Now, if that had happened in Detroit, or if that's something that happens in towns all across this country, the falling apart of our neighborhoods where people are just you know, you look at some of these families that the house has been in the family for years. This person has been in the city for all these years. They've been making their mortgage payments. It can tear apart an entire community. And there's virtually no reason why that should have to happen. And this lady takes it straight on and she says, I'm not afraid of Wall Street. I have the power. It's a legitimate power of government. And it's truly holding her town together.
Mark, thanks for the call. What do you think about that? I mean, whether that particular policy is interesting or something you'd approve of, what do you think the impact of foreclosures on that community sense of home that you were talking about earlier?
Well, that's really inspiring. I'm writing this down because for the sequel, that's definitely a place I would like to visit. And that's that whole feeling then, again, of that the mayor has of home as a community. She's not going to let that happen to her community. And I have a man in the book named Mike Lofton. He's director of a program in Santa Fe called HomeWise. And this is a not-for-profit, and he's helping people become homeowners. And a lot of them have been foreclosed on in the past. So he's saying owning a home is the great American dream, and also it can be the great security provider. But he thinks that this is the perfect time to buy a house. But he is bound and determined to have people go into it and give them education about it and what the financial situation is today. And he studies each one sort of on a case-by-case basis and for what their potential is, what they need, and what goes into this process. So he's working on that angle, and I think that's really commendable. You're giving classes on what it takes to buy and maintain a home because in this atmosphere, in these financial times, so they won't get themselves into those dire straits and won't be hoodwinked. So,
just in our last minute, one more story you tell that's kind of universal. Every family will face it at some point or another. Uh-huh. A senior citizen making decision, stay at home, go into some kind of assisted care.
Yeah.
Do you see people successfully making that adjustment of a concept of home when they move out, when they move into some kind of facility?
Yeah, it really depends on the individual. And I started talking to a man in Iowa who owns 6 retirement homes, I believe. And he said that almost inevitably people make that decision too late. Lots of times they move in and they say, oh, I wish I'd done this before. but it is a huge adjustment. And I talked to a lot of people who in Iowa then who had come from a farming base. And I think farmers have a particularly rooted feeling about home, about that place, a specific place. And so it was hard for them to say, I mean, lots of times their children would just have to come to them, or their children would try and keep them in their own homes, which is so hard, and they're not equipped to do that.
That was Sally Ohms. She's a journalist and author of Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. We spoke with her back in August. If you'd like to hear more great Central Time interviews, you can always head over to WPR.org and check out our audio archives. Just click the Central Time page and you'll find hundreds of hours of past interviews for your listening pleasure. We'd also like to invite you to check out our social media pages. You can keep up with the latest program updates, interact with us, and check out some behind-the-scenes photos. That's on Facebook, we're Central Time on WPR. On Twitter, it's @CentralTimeWPR. Also, stay tuned to the Ideas Network after the show for the Big River Radio Wave Holiday Special. It's a variety show. It features the Riverbenders, Kenny Solway, Al Ross, Ensemble Limousine, Twin Cities comedian Amber Preston, and more. That's coming up today after 6. Coming up after the news, the shopping mall is bound to be busy today, but what about the rest of the year? We'll talk with a guest who wonders if the shopping mall as we know it is going extinct. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for spending your Christmas Eve with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you haven't finished up your Christmas shopping yet, there's a good chance you are on your way to the mall right about now, or you're in the parking lot trying to find a way out. Our next guest says there's a gloomy reality, though, that we're not talking about. The fact that many of these malls themselves will soon be shutting down. And it's not just for economic reasons, though that's part of it. Joining us now is economist and historian Neil Howe. He's the president and founding partner of Life Course Associates. He wrote an op-ed for USA Today called "Are Malls Becoming Extinct?" Neil, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, do we have that right? A lot of malls are going to be shutting down soon?
Well, they've already been shutting down. There's actually only been one mall built in the United States since the beginning of the Great Recession. And in earlier decades, as many of us remember, earlier in the post-war era, every year we were building sometimes hundreds of malls across America. By one estimate, 1,000 of America's 10,000 malls will be shutting down over the past over the next decade, you know, from now until the mid-2020s. And there's actually, if anyone's interested, there's a website called deadmall.com, which just has nothing but kind of gloomy, gothic pictures of all of the shut-down malls across America, the ones that have already gone out of business. So it's a reality that's already in play, and now we're really sort of investigating kind of why it's happening and where malls are going.
We'll tweet that site to Central Time WPR, the deadmall.com site. We'll put a link there. Well, let's talk about why you write about economic and cultural reasons. Let's tease out some of the economics here first. We, every year around this time, we in the media obsess over holiday shopping numbers, sales numbers, but it's not one size fits all. Malls, in particular, are seeing worse sales. They're in more dire straits than the rest of the stores out there. Is that right?
Part of the story with malls is kind of the story of our overall economy and society over the past decade. Particularly if you look since 2007, 2008, there are some malls which continue to do well, and in general, they are the malls which, before the Great Recession, were selling the most per square foot. In other words, these were the most successful malls. These targeted generally consumers in the $100,000 plus income bracket. Those malls, on the other hand, that did not do that were on the other side of the economic divide, have done worse. And obviously, we've got a lot of Americans who've doing a little bit less, shopping at the Gap or Penny's or Macy's and doing it at Walmart and other places, which were probably less likely to be in malls. So part of this story is an economic gap. Part of the story, though, is generational and an age gap. Increasingly, malls are targeting not only an affluent consumer, but an older consumer. These are often boomers or even, the pre-boomer silent generation, who generally are pretty well off today. And they were used to they're very used to going to malls. You know, the first malls started up among much great fanfare as the symbol of America's future in the late 1950s and early 1960s. And these are generations which have very positive association with malls, and eventually, of course, raise their kids in malls. So there's a story too of what's happened to the economy. I would say that The generation that probably was most greatly influenced by malls in their childhood is probably Generation X, mm-hmm. Born in the 1960s and 70s. And by that time, malls were being turned into kind of experience lifestyle centers. You didn't just shop there. You danced. You went to movies. You entertained yourself. And these kids spent a lot of their childhood hanging out there. Very interesting. Two things are happening. X's, as they are growing older, and of course now Generation X are now the, parents and, on the verge of midlife now, and they are the major retail shoppers. They are economically hard-pressed, and they are moving, of course, to digital. They're moving to the e-tailers. They're moving to the power centers, the factory outlets, the category killers. So So they're moving to places that either can, you know, a physical place that can, that's really not so much a mall experience, but a lowest priced experience, where they're moving to, you know, they're moving to Amazon and all the e-tailers.
I want to jump in on the generational story for a minute, though. I mean, you mentioned my generation, Generation X, spending time at malls, and it was an activity. Going to the mall, it was a bit of a drive for me. It was in a rural area, but it was a thing people did. The teenagers met up in a mall and hung out there all day. Whether or not we bought that much is another story. You say that's going away with current generations, even going to the mall to not spend money.
That's going away for millennials. In other words, the kids born since the early to mid-1980s, these younger kids now even in their 20s, spent much less of their childhood in malls. And in fact, you can actually see this. If you're interested, this is part of the Monitoring the Future project, which actually has been asking this question of high school seniors since the late 1970s. And actually, there's about one-third decline in the share of kids who say they frequently go to malls. There's about a 50% rise in the share of kids who say they never go to malls. Part of the issue now is that kids are busier now. They don't have time to hang out at malls. They're busier studying. They're busier with their scheduled activities. And their parents are much more protective of kids. You know, a lot of Xers hang out at malls because their kids really didn't care where they were during most of the day. That's really changed now that Xers are parents, right? And who absolutely want to know where their kids are every hour of the day. So that's part of the interesting change here is that the younger people are going less. You know, the youth, teens, early 20s are going less to the malls, even while the parents themselves, for economic reasons, are kind of shifting their own, buying patterns elsewhere.
So you mentioned part of that money now for the Generation Xers and our offspring is going online, and part of it is going to the big box stores. That seems like it's taking over the physical and economic real estate that the malls used to occupy. Can you talk about that transition a little?
Yeah, and that's a big war going on now because, of course, the big box stores are themselves under attack, waging a desperate war of survival with the e-tailers. So you see, Best Buy and Best Buy is obviously still around, but some of the others like Circuit City have gone down. These used to be and still are what we call category killers, right? I mean, they're these huge stores which have all kinds of stuff in them. But they are feeling the heat, and this is the war of what's called bricks versus clicks. And for a long time, it was thought that these big physical stores were doomed, but now they're beginning to fight back with in-store analytics and all kinds of ways of offering you promotions and so on in your cell phones and giving you all kinds of special ways of analyzing how people move around in their stores. It's interesting now the physical stores now have ways of actually tracking what's going on with shoppers inside their physical, retail outlets in ways that allow them to gain some of the informational advantages that the Amazon.coms had. But it's a brutal contest between these two. Malls are kind of out to one side. I think malls are becoming increasingly, again, lifestyle centers. They're focusing more on things that you have to be there to do things, cutting your hair, getting a doctor's visit. They're even leasing spaces out now to churches, art shows, walkathons, bands. I mean, increasingly, the mall is a place where you do things, again, where your physical presence is required. In my opinion, the long-term future of the mall in the hands of the millennials will be turning malls back into sort of almost quasi-community centers where we do, community-oriented things. And it's less a place where you buy and sell, more a place where you do things together or have services provided for you, often in groups, where you just got to be there.
It sounds a little like what a lot of downtowns were trying to do when their business was taken away by malls, trying to make themselves gathering points and community events to try to lure people down there.
And to some extent, that's working. That has worked. And you see one of the biggest gains in real estate you know, construction, housing unit construction, are multi-unit dwellings in core urban areas where a lot of young people are flocking, young professionals are flocking. Just look at the incredible boom in micro apartments, for instance, sort of, you know, gentrified micro apartments where young people don't have to have cars and they can move in and they can work there. And I think that helps. There will always be a place for the mall, though, because it's either inner or outer suburban, and these are places where people will raise their families. The one problem with core urban areas is that people always associate them. Even though these urban areas are much safer than they used to be, the crime rates are way down. Most people don't want to raise families there, so they will move out to do that. So I think you will find some renaissance in sort of these neo-urban, you know, mixed-use inner-city areas. But I think you will also see this new concept of the mall, again, less oriented toward just, you know, picking up all all the stuff you need, and more oriented kind of revitalizing a real sense of community. And I think that is something, by the way, that millennials really are looking for. If we know anything about them and their attitudes toward what they want in America for the future, it is a greater sense of community. And you certainly do see that in their voting behavior, among other things.
We're talking with Neil Howe about the future of the shopping mall, and we want to hear from you. Do you still shop at the old-fashioned shopping mall? What about it keeps bringing you back, or why don't you go? And are you one of these people who grew up hanging out at the mall with your friends? Do you drop your kids off there now? Would you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Neil Howe about the tough outlook for U.S. shopping malls. Hundreds of them, he says, expected to close over the next decade. And we're taking your calls, too. Do you still go to the mall? Why or why not? Do you have fond memories of shopping there, maybe when the malls first came into being, or hanging out as a kid, as a teenager? Do you take your kids there and drop them off and let them hang out with their friends like we used to? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Neil, you mentioned earlier, one of the exceptions is the upscale mall. Can you paint us a picture of what kind of stores are there, what the experience is like for these malls catering to people earning in the six digits?
Well, these are, we have a great example in the greater D.C. area, which is Tyson's Corner and Tyson's Galleria. I mean, these are the Nordstrom's and the L.L. Bean's we all know what brands are being sold there, and they're trendy, they're high status brands, and again, the typical customer is older. The typical consumer is older. I think one of the things that people don't realize is happening in America today is that wealth and income is. They're kind of generational drivers for this, but wealth and income is shifting up the age scale. So, you know, it's one of the most notable findings of the Fed Survey of Consumer Finances that came out in 2010. It was for the first time households in the 75 plus age bracket, this 75 plus, had the highest median net worth for the first time ever. Back in the 1960s, this age bracket had the lowest. So you can see there's a shift. We see a record number of grandparents taking over custody for their grandchildren. They're paying for the extended family vacations. They're starting college trust funds for their grandkids. They have a lot more money to spend, and they're looking at their kids who don't have as many jobs, don't have as many opportunities. Interestingly, since the last peak of employment, at the end of 2007, and I think that month was something like November or December of 2007, the overall economy has lost 3 million jobs, but that's 6 million job loss under age 60 and 3 million more jobs for people over age 60.
Wow.
Right? So these are boomers who are just aging, you know, working in place. They're not retiring. And they are increasingly the ones going out. They're eating out. They're They have expense accounts. They're going to the restaurants, the better restaurants in the mall. They're buying stuff. They're buying stuff not just for themselves, but for their kids. And as you know, a lot more of these 20-something kids are living at home in multi-generational families, right? That is also returning to America today, partly because in some cases their kids can't find jobs. I think in some cases because they simply get along really well now. Boomers get along very well with their first wave millennial kids. They often watch the same movies, listen to the same songs, wear the same brand name clothing. So I think you're seeing a real shift from what we used to consider the traditional pattern, which was, you know, older people aren't as well off, younger people, you know, prime age, working adults, you know, went to the malls, did all the shopping. All of that is really beginning to shift. And I think this is in any way particularly interesting for Gen Xers. I don't know if many of them may recall kind of a film producer, Kevin Smith, Rob. I don't know if you remember.
Sure.
But produced the movie Clerks and then Mallrats. You remember Mallrats?
I do. I want to jump in, Neil, because we've got full phone lines and not too much time left. We've got Jack Jack with us in Eau Claire. Jack, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. It's interesting. I'm a 70-year-old male, and so I've experienced the whole gamut of the malls. And at one time, when they first arrived and prospered and grew, they were great shopping destinations. And, of course, as you guys mentioned, they became social centers for kids later on. Now, for me as a 70-year-old, they're just a great place to go and get walking exercise in the winter. They're not a shopping destination at all because the digital age has changed all of that. From my perspective, you go out and find what you want on the internet, refine what it is with its features, and then search for where you're going to get the best deal, whether you want to pay shipping or if you can find it locally in some store. It doesn't have to be a mall where you don't have to pay shipping and taxes are cheaper.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jack. Neil, a common story there, I bet.
That's the nightmare of all the brick-and-mortar stores. It's called showrooming. And you walk in and you look around. You see all these. You can actually pick up and feel and look at all these interesting electronic products that we'll be looking at. Then you whip out your cell phone and you look and say, gee, I wonder where I can buy this cheapest. So the ultimate horror story are the reports from many stores that people are actually buying the product from Amazon or from an e-tailer. Well, they're actually in the store handling the good that's on the shelf, right? So,
we'll go back. Thanks for the call, Jack. We've got Tom in Madison now. Tom, hi.
Hi. I guess my comment is basically, our question is the same as the previous caller. And I work part-time at a retail store in a mall. And what I hear is that what the retailers are pushing for is more online sales, so they don't have to pay their employees to sell and pay them commission. And that we would end up just being there to show people products, they would go home and buy them online. I'm just wondering what you think of that, and I will hang up and listen.
Interesting. So the store is trying to drive online sales from their own online entity there, Neil.
No, and I think that's true. One of the problems with bricks and mortar is that it's obviously very expensive to actually maintain a store, a physical store. And if you're also right, if you're paying commissions to actual store people and all that, rather than just having it all digital, how do you afford that? How do you afford all that extra money from a business point of view that you're spending? One of the things you do is you can offer extra in-person services. For instance, if you take a look at stores now that are offering electronic products, this is, for instance, what with the Geek Squad, for instance, at Best Buy. But for instance, you offer all kinds of ways of helping people install products. You recommend, you know, ideal ways of putting systems together. You try to leverage as much as possible the advantages of the personal experience and the personal advice and counseling. And arguably, in the area sometimes of, you know, setting up a home theater in the electronic area, that can actually work. And there's stores that make that system work. But it puts a tremendous pressure on other stores. I think the other thing you can do as a mall is make it an experience to give you other reasons to go there. But again, it's very hard to prevent people from actually going in, looking at the product, and buying it elsewhere. In terms of lack of taxation, as you know, the federal government is moving to sort of level the playing field. Now, increasingly, you do have to pay taxes. That's been a big fight, which Amazon is basically throwing in the towel now. Basically, Congress has said, well, wait, Amazon, as long as you do any business at all in these states, you know, even have a representative, you know, even come within this geographic domain of the state, you are doing business in it, and you have to pay state taxes, you know, retail taxes on the sale. So I think actually that battle is being lost. And so to the extent that these e-tailers have a tax advantage, I think within the next 5 years, we're going to see that largely disappear.
Neil, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it. That's Neil Howe, president and founding partner of LifeCourse Associates. He wrote an op-ed for USA Today. It's called "Are Malls Becoming Extinct?"